Hello again there, folks. So one of the themes which pops up quite a lot in dissident right circles is the dichotomy and the difference between the English people and the German people and how that's played out over the course of centuries. And I thought I'd like to take a bit of a deep dive into that, and we can draw on Oswald Spengler's book on Prussian socialism, and this is mainly going to be the part on Prussians and Englishmen where Spengler gets a task about what the differences are. And there's a few things for people who this may be new to, or questions, so people who are a bit more exposed to Spengler's thought. He is, of course, the man who wrote Fall and Decline of Western Civilization, and the prime symbol of European civilization over the last 1,000 years ago or so is the symbol of the infinite, and we are Faustian man is ours. So unlike, for example, in China it's the Tao, and as the primary symbol, and for Islam it's the dome. And this, what we're going to get into here, plays out within this. So both the English and the Germans are just two competing strands within Faustian civilization. There's also a third one, according to Spengler, which is the S Catholicism, essentially Spanish. And so we can jump into the text. And the thing about Spengler is that he does think in very broad strokes and over very. He doesn't do facts and statistics and nitpick. It's very broad brush strokes here, which opens him up to criticism because people are going to say, what about this or that? But nevertheless, I do think that there's something quite fascinating here, and it can. You change your view, essentially, on history and look back at history. And when you begin to think in Spenglerian terms as well, you do, and you think it over, you do see these signs all over the place, actually. And so this isn't the whole text. I'll link the entire thing below. These are the ones which I just thought, because I'd be on for hours and hours. This is just a sort of entry point, really, with some selected passages which we can go through and have a look at. And so the organized colonization of the Slavic frontier involved Germans of all tribes, but the area was ruled by nobles from Lower Saxony. Thus, the Prussian people by origin is closely related to the English. It was the same Saxons, Frisians, and Angles who, as roving Viking bands and often under Norman and Danish names, subdued the Celtic Britons. Saxon settlements sprang up along the Thames, just as they had in the desert-like region near the Havel and Spree rivers, a stretch of land comparable in desolate expanse and fateful importance only to Latium, the Roman Campania. By contemplating the rigid figures of Duke Widdicund, Margrave Giro, and Henry the Lion, we can gain an impression of the type of men who first set this people on its path to destiny. And so what Spengler's going to introduce here is the idea that the English and the Germans are descended from the same stock, and they've separated and ended up having completely different world views, and philosophies and ways of being in the world. That's really what we're going to get into here. And he continues, but the Viking spirit and the communal spirit of the Teutonic Knights gradually gave rise to two antithetical ethical imperatives. One side bore the Germanic idea actively within itself, while the other felt itself subject to it. Personal independence on the one hand, and supra-personal community spirit on the other. Today we refer to these concepts as individualism and socialism. Virtues of the most exalted kind are summarized by these words. In the one case, personal responsibility, self-reliance, determination, and initiative, and in the other, loyalty, discipline, selflessness, and a sense of obligation. To be free and to serve, there is nothing more difficult than this. A people whose spirit and being are capable of it A nation that can truly serve and be free deserves to take upon itself a great destiny. And so the individualism is where we're going to go. This is the Anglo-liberalism, and the socialism is the Germanic form. That's the what became the Germanic norm, despite the fact that we are talking about essentially the same people who've splintered and gone their separate ways and ended up with, one has socialism, as understood, that the concept of socialism is different here. This is Prussian socialism, which is very hierarchical. It isn't sort of lefty liberal socialism that we hear about now. In fact, we're going to come back to that later. And of course, individualism. And so here we see the two ways of being in the world is completely at odds. Service, that is the style of old Prussia, similar to that of old Spain, which also created a people by engaging in knightly warfare against the heathen. Not I, but we. A feeling of community to which every individual sacrifices his whole being. The individual does not matter, he must offer himself up to the totality. All exist for all, and all partake of that glorious inner freedom, the libertas obo dientia, which has always distinguished the best exemplars of Prussian breeding, the Prussian army, Prussian civil service, and August Bebel's workers' brigades are all products of this breeding principle. So you can see that despite the fact this is of the Prussian, he uses the term Prussian, but it's really because he's getting at the core of the German identity as he sees it. But you can see that it isn't in this way, the Prussian socialism is absolutely not about equality. It's about collectivism and belonging to the totality of the people and the state, which is very Germanic. And we can, you can see the writing on the wall for some for some quite turbulent times ahead. But that's what this is all about. The urge to individuality and independence, however, later drove many of those with Viking blood in their veins, Englishmen, Germans, and Scandinavians, to seek their fortunes on the American prairie. This adventure was, in effect, a late resumption of the expeditions from Greenland at the time of the Eddas, when Viking touched the Canadian coast. A tremendous migration of Teutons, filled with a longing for distance and limitless expanses. So this is the Faustian infinite coming up again, which is a recurring theme. The Teutons, the Nordics, Faustian man went to America and found America became an offshoot of Faustian man, and you can see it in a symbolic form as the infinite expanses across, well, first across the sea, which led to the Eddas and the discovery of Greenland, coast of Canada. So first it was the sea as the infinite expanse, and then it became the infinite expanse of the prairies in America. And I like about Spengler, it's like a motif which keeps coming back. And so, tremendous migration of Teutons filled with a longing of distance and limitless expanses. Teams of adventurers who were to lay the groundwork for yet another people with Saxon characteristics. Yet this new people was to arise apart from the maternal soil of the Faustian culture, because they weren't in Europe anymore, and thus lacked the inner basalt of which Goethe speaks in his poem America. It retained certain races of noble blood and the concomitant virtues of vigour and industriousness, but was without roots and therefore without a future. So that's Spengler's particularly snarky take on what is America, essentially, is that it is the Faustian man, but dislocated from his roots, and it's a sort of a vast cello empire. So what we're going to head into here is, I think, one of the key parts of this. Such was the origin of the English and Prussian types. The difference between them is that between a people whose soul has developed out of an awareness of insular security and one that has been forced to maintain a frontier without natural borders to protect its enemy. In England, splendid isolation replaced the organised state. Now, what we mean here is that the English, so the section of the Saxons who went to England, They were surrounded by the seas, and this offered them a large degree of protection from outside forces. All you had to worry about was large navies, but that didn't they and then after that, a land invasion, and this had an effect on the way the English developed and the thinking of the English. Whereas you can contrast that with the Prussian German plain, which is surrounded on all sides by enemies, and so this is the key here. This too had an effect on them, and this meant that the Germans would huddle together and collectivize, and the state would become their barrier in effect. Whereas the English didn't have to do that. The English were so secure that the philosophies and the thinking of what became normal in England, in the Englishman, was to always try and distance himself from centralized power, because it just didn't matter, because you were so secure on your island. And you see this going, what she's going to get into, you see this going through so many of the philosophies and ideologies which came out of England. And it's always about being an individual and away from the centralized authority. And for the Germans, they didn't have that luxury, and so they became part of a totality, and they gravitated towards the centralized state and the military and duty and honor towards the whole out of sheer necessity, because they didn't have the water surrounding them. So that's where he's going there. A stateless nation was only possible under those conditions. Isolation was the necessary ingredient in the development of the spirit of modern England, a spirit that first gained full confidence in the 17th century, when the English became the undisputed masters of their island. It is a case of creative topography. The English people shaped and formed itself, while the Prussian people were shaped in the 18th century by the Hohenzollern, who brought them the frontier experience of southern Central Europe, and who had thus become advocates of the organized state. As real political entities, a state and non-state, Prussia and England embody the maximum and minimum functioning of the suprapersonal socialistic principle. The liberal English state is completely intangible. It makes not a single claim on the individual citizen, nor does it make of him a meaningful element in a political system. It serves him exclusively as a means to an end. During the century between Waterloo and the World War, meaning the First World War, this is written after World War I and before World War II, England went without compulsory education, compulsory military service, and compulsory social security out of sheer antipathy towards these negative privileges. The hostility of the English towards centralized organization is neatly expressed in their word society, which has displaced in their way of thinking the ideal notion of the state. And so you can see that for the Germans, loyalty and duty towards the state ran in their blood, and in the English it was completely opposite. And it's hard to refute that. When so much, well, as he says, you had to be sort of forced into the military, because essentially the Englishman just wanted to be left alone as the individual, away from centralized authority. And you will see it in people like Hobbes and Locke. Classic liberalism is particularly English, and with a smattering of French, but mainly it's an English Anglo-liberalism, and it was allowed because the state didn't need to lay claim too much claim on the citizens. Long, long gone those days now, however. We're not there anymore. England did away with the principle of the organized state and put in its place the notion of the free private citizen. The citizen demands permission to fight alone in the ruthless struggle for existence, and this is the only way he can satisfy his Viking instincts. Buckle, Malthus, and Darwin later postulated that the basic essence of society was the naked struggle for existence. And so, once you've entered into this particularly individualistic mindset that the English have, you do then have a kind of a dog-eat-dog Darwinian mode of being. And it's surprise, surprise, Darwin. And one of these strange things that pops up, Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution is also an English creation, which fits perfectly with the English individualism and being alone in the world to scratch out your own living in that harsh way, which if you couldn't actually do if you were in the situation of the Germans, because you would just be invaded. Because an individual doesn't make individuals as opposed to a group don't make for a very good military, and that's the luxury that the Germans never had. And they were absolutely right, at least as far as their own country and people were concerned. To be sure, in modern England, this principle operates in a highly refined and perfected fashion, but evidence of a more rudimentary adherence to it can be found in the Icelandic sagas, where such behaviour is obviously spontaneous and not borrowed from another culture. The forces with which William the Conqueror took England in 1066 could be called a society of knightly adventurers, and English trading companies have subdued and expropriated entire countries, most recently since 1890, the inland regions of South Africa. Gradually, the entire English nation assumed the characteristics of a society. The old Norse instinct for piracy and clever trading has, in the end, influenced the Englishman's attitude toward all of reality, including property, work, foreign peoples, and the weaker individuals and classes among his own people. The same instinct has also yielded political techniques that are extremely effective weapons in the struggle for mastery of the globe. And so, when we go back to this idea of the core Saxon stock being split in two, and the English got the Viking side of it, that may surprise a lot of people. But what he's getting at here is that when you look at how the Vikings operated, they too were individualistic, decentralized. They weren't really in hock to some centralized state. They were pillaging and raping along the coastlines, pretty much just free under the stars, doing what they wanted. And what Spengler's getting at here is that this is the actual spirit of the English people on their island, and the individualism is quite brutal. You can imagine in a Viking settlement where the or the weakest of the Vikings just being left to sort of rot, and this is in a way preempting the English class system as well. So you do get these stratas in society which would have been quite alien to a lot of other people, a lot of other Europeans actually, was the class system in England is a product of this dog-eat-dog, have a very hierarchical world, which is, this is strange because we're used to thinking of England in terms of being gentle and civilized, and yet from the view from the outside, it must have been quite brutal. And further is that with the individualism and then the focus on capital wealth, that too is just for Spengler is a more sophisticated form of the Viking plundering. It's just that in sort of the 1800s and as after the Enlightenment, the Vikings were wearing suits and they had banks and they were big investment capital, but they were still using it to subdue and extract resources from other people. That's how he's that's where he's going there. Again, it's very controversial. Another way to look at it is that he's also comparing the Viking. What you can think of it here, what he's doing is if you compare the English Viking to the Teutonic German knight. So the knight is he has duties to a higher value system and to a centralized state and an authority, and the Viking not so much. That's where he's going here, and you can see this that duty bound society in Germany, as it was, and the Viking take would be in England, the two are against each other. A concept complementary to that of society is the private citizen. He represents the sum of certain positive ethical qualities, which, like all great ethical virtues, are not acquired through training or education, but are born in the blood and perfected after passing through generation after generation. The peculiarly English style of politics is essentially one that involves private citizens or groups of such individuals. This, and only this, is the very meaning of parliamentary government. Cecil Rhodes was a private citizen who conquered foreign countries. The American billionaires are private citizens who rule foreign countries by means of an inferior class of professional politicians. German liberalism, on the other hand, is ethically valueless. It merely says no to the state and is unable to justify its opposition by offering equally high-minded and vigorous positive suggestions. There's two things here. So the offshoot, the Faustian offshoot in America, as according to Spengler, is ruled by money. This is what's happened. This is the bargain. The money masters have outwitted Faustian man in a way, and they are now in hoc and subservient to moneyed interests as we approach modernity, and the Americans in particular. And so the politicians are just puppets of the money power. And at the same time, Spengler finds it ridiculous that in Germany, like, that liberals could exist at all. He thinks that this kind of Anglo-liberalism in Germany is completely absurd, and that they don't have any kind of frame of reference or deeper ontology, and so all they can really do is moan about the German state, because it isn't natural to them. And they're just trying to be trendy and fashionable by adopting these English and American liberal positions. Among the political attitudes that prevail in Germany today, only socialism has the potentiality of inner value and integrity. Again, this is not the fluffy lefty socialism that we think of today. It's the opposite. We'll come back to that. Liberalism is for the simple-minded. For those who like to chat a great deal about things they can never achieve. That is how we Germans are. We cannot possibly be like the English. We can only be caricatures of them, and that we have been often enough. So again, he cannot stand the idea that English liberalism is becoming somewhat trendy in Germany. Every man for himself, that is an English idea. Every man for every other man, that is the Prussian way. Liberalism, however, means the state for itself and every man for himself. That is a formula impossible to follow unless one is willing to take the liberal course, which is to say one thing while being dead set against its opposite, but in the end to let the opposite take over. So Spengler is going to go off in the essay again on a long tirade against Germans who adopt English liberalism. The English were united by a common feeling of success and good fortune, unlike the Prussians, who were moved by a sense of challenge and duty. We may think of the English as Olympians of the business world at the banquet table, or as Vikings returned from distant explorations, but not as knights on the field of battle. Next to noble parentage, wealth is the major condition for acceptance in the group. It is also the criterion for rank within the group's social structure. Wealth is the Englishman's prime virtue, his distinguishing mark, his goal and his ideal. Today, only England has what may be called social culture, although it does not possess any other, more philosophical form of culture. The English are a people of profound superficiality. We Germans, and in the land of poets and thinkers, in scare quotes, so often display merely a superficial profundity. So both the English and the Germans have come in for a Spenglerian slap there. But once again, he notes that the primary characteristic and almost definition of the English upper classes is just wealth. And whereas for the Germans, it's duty and loyalty. Again, this is somewhat controversial, but I think the Spengler would point to say the class system and how poverty stricken some of the parts of England were throughout the ages, while the elites dined out and got wealthy and built mansions. And it's interesting also to note that Marx moved to England to when he propagated his ideas, and to study how hard it was for the lower classes, because in that context it seems ripe for the plucking in a way that the Germans wouldn't, in a way that Germany would have been a lot harder nut to crack from the Marxist perspective, because there was a higher element to it. Whereas in England, it was just all about money. Either you had a lot of it or you had didn't. That was the discourse, and it still is today, in all fairness. But I think it's also the case in Germany now as well. The English, indeed the whole world, will never understand that the Prussian ethic carries with it a profound inner independence. For people of sufficient mental capacities, a system of social obligations guarantees a supreme freedom of inner life, which is not possible under a system of social privileges. A mentality such as that of General Moltke is unthinkable in England. The Englishman pays for his practical freedom with the loss of the other kind of freedom. He is inwardly a slave, whether as Puritan, rationalist, sensualist, or materialist. For 2 centuries now, he has been the inventor of all philosophies that do away with inner independence. Most recently, he has produced Darwinism, which makes man's entire psychic makeup dependent on material forces. And so, he's having a slap up the scientific method, and rationalism is a way of understanding the world, which is also a particularly English thing. In order to overcome man's inborn lethargy, the Prussian socialist ethic maintains that the chief aim of life is not happiness. Do your duty, it says, by doing your work. The English capitalist ethic says, get rich and then you won't have to work anymore. This is again is a an very deep take and a true one. So in this case, the purpose of capitalism is to get away from having to work, because if this goes back to the individualism, we are only going to look at under Anglo-liberalism, you're only interested in, you're only going to take care of yourself. And so the idea is first to get rid of the state, and then to use capitalism to get as much money, and then you would actually have this freedom, which from the Prussian German point perspective of Spengler is actually futile, because genuine freedom and a sense of purpose and being belongs in loyalty and duty to something greater than yourself. It's like fire and ice, really. The working masses of ambitious nations have understood it well. As late as the 19th century, it produced the Yankee type with his irresistible practical optimism. The other motto is forbidding. It is for the few who wish to inject it into the community and thus forces it upon the masses. The first maxim is for a stateless country, for egoists and Viking types with the urge for constant personal combat, such as we find in English sportsmanship. Again, it's just a little note there that even in the sports, especially the upper class sports in England, they did tend to be solo, individualistic. Think of tennis or golf or these kinds of things. Or riding a horse was another one. Rather than a team sport, the individualism comes back again and again and again. It implies extreme independence of mind, the right to gain happiness at the expense of others, as long as one's strength holds out. In other words, scientific Darwinism. And again, you can see that Viking mentality. You can compare it to the Viking mentality, I think, again, where it's just a matter of individual strength and will. The other, however, is an expression of the socialist idea in all its profundity, the will to power, the struggle for happiness, but for the happiness of the totality, not of the individual. In this sense, Frederick William I, and not Marx, was the first conscious socialist. The Universal Socialist movement had its start with this exemplary personality. Kant, with his categorical imperative, provided the movement with a formula. So Spengler then briefly contrasts the different philosophers that have come out of Germany and England, and again, it's Hobbes as opposed to Hegel. Now, Hobbes is the state is the Leviathan, and then Hegel is again looking at the totality of it, and these things repeat again and again and again. And just as an aside, it's interesting to think about the art forms as well. When we look at the what is the English what is the real authentic English expression in an artistic sense? If you could say it was literature, with Shakespeare, with poetry, Charles Dickens writing novels, Chaucer, and so on. And what you'll notice there is that it does come down to being just an individual with a quill or a pen expressing his ideas about the world. Whereas when we look at the German, if we think what is the quintessential German artistic art form, it's classic music, essentially. And in classic music, what you have, of course, is a leader in the composer, and then you've got this entire orchestra, and it all boils down to them playing their instruments and expressing themselves perfectly in sync. So it's fascinating. You do see these things pop up again and again. And here we come to a key point in the whole essay. Vikings and knights, both of these types, live on the antithesis of the English and Prussian moral systems. The philosophical teachings that have since arisen out of these separate worlds of sensibility, the progeny of the philosophers of both nations, all bear the same distinguishing marks. The Englishman is a utilitarian, in fact, the only one in Western Europe, and of course, the only people on an island as well. So it's the island mentality has led to individualism, wanting to be separate from centralised power structures. And this is what repeats itself over and over again. But the idea of a knight, just as to repeat, the idea of the knight is somebody who is duty-bound to a higher purpose, and the Viking isn't. The Viking is out for booty and treasure, as he calls it. In England, both parties had long been the sovereign initiators and leaders of policy, but in Prussia there existed a state, and the parties, founded for reasons of parliamentary protocol, became merely critics of the state, whereas in England the functions of the parties were a direct outgrowth of the actual confederation of the people as a commercial entity. And so what you then happens in England is where the people, as Spengler says here, the people themselves have become nothing more than a commercial entity. So you can see no way out of the trap. And in you get the sense that you can see in this purely materialistic paradigm, even when you do attempt to inject some socialism into it, it becomes just an argument about who has, like, the money. I want, these people deserve more, some of your money, or the counter argument would be that you don't deserve any money, you have to go out there into the world and scratch for yourself. And so whatever side you take, you're arguing about money, which is essentially the left-right divide in the Anglo world. And in a sense, the Prussians, what Spengler's saying is that in Prussia, they had a third way. It's actually third positionism. And in spite of all of... And another point on that is that, just on the money thing, is that in England, in Britain, 10 Downing Street is the home of the Prime Minister, and 11 Downing Street, so literally next door, is the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Like, that's how important money is. You can imagine in Prussia, it would be the office for like, it would be the Field Marshal's office or something like that. All you need to do is look at a picture and compare Gladstone to Bismarck, who are both leaders of the same time, and you'll find that the Englishman as ruler is wearing the garb of a businessman. And for the Prussian, for Bismarck in particular, it was the military officer. And so what you see is two symbols of one people who have splintered and ended up having radically different understandings of the world. In spite of all this, the two great universal principles continue to oppose each other. Dictatorship of money or of organisational talent, the world as booty or as a true state, wealth or political authority, success or vocation, both of Germany's socialistic parties must unite against the one enemy of the idea that they share, our inner England, capitalism and parliamentary liberalism. Now, so this is before World War II. Spengler didn't actually have that much time for the National Socialists, but he was a conservative. But you can see here, even in conservative intellectuals of the era, there is this deep concern about the encroachment of capitalism in onto German society, and that it would have that same breaking down the order of the nation. And of course it was going to have devastating consequences, and which is why this is such a hot topic within dissident right circles, because people fall out and bicker about this quite a lot. And I've done here is try to be as objective as I can to offer some nuance. I think Spengler has a few blind spots. I think there's a third party here, which, if we think of it, the way Spengler's framing this is that the spirit of the Vikings ended up making global capitalism, and the pillaging of nations for capitalism is just a more nuanced and advanced form of the Viking plundering the coastlines of Europe. And the problem with that is that there's a third party involved, which I can't even talk about. But in a way, that even then, it would be becoming, the elites became too distant from the base, and it was then became part of a global class of people, and they got outwitted when they got involved with big, all-powerful central banking cartels. Rothschilds kind of thing springs to mind, of course, which leads to all kinds of conspiracies. But in this case, I think it's just interesting to contrast the paths that the two peoples have taken. And on that, I think Oswald Spengler's article is well worth considering and has a lot of truth to it. The chapter that comes after this one is about Marx. He'll focus in on Marx, but I've got a feeling that would have to be a bit shoot special. So I hope you enjoyed this, everyone, and thanks a lot, and thanks for all the people who have been supporting us on Patreon and Subscribestar and stuff, and I'll catch you.